Good morning and welcome. Rise in body and or spirit. Turn to number 1024 in your teal hymnal and we'll sing together When the Spirit Says Do. We'll sing four verses, replacing the word do with sing in the second one, and then shout, and then do again. You to turn to the person next to you and greet one another, say hello. We'll now sing hymn number 157 in your gray hymnal, Step by Step, The Longest March. Chalice lighting this morning will be by Crete, our 11th grade junior. Crete likes to read, And she will light our chalice this morning. And we'll say the covenant together. Love is the spirit of this church, and reason is its guide. To dwell together in peace, to seek truth and freedom, and to serve human need. This is our covenant. We're so glad you're all here to worship. If today is your first day with us, we're especially happy to have you here. If you didn't check in on your way in, please do so on your way out so that we can be in touch. There are many events coming up in the life of the church, and please take a look at your bulletin and check out the sign-up table in the narthex and see the posted material in the fellowship hall. Please do stick around after church for coffee, cookies, and community. We are so glad that each of you and every one of you is here today. I want to offer a special welcome to our guest minister this morning, Reverend Ashley Horan. Our senior minister, Matthew Johnson, invited Ashley to come preach today because he's been so impressed with the important work Ashley has been doing to support the work of racial justice in the Twin Cities. We're thrilled she can be here today. Ashley is the Executive Director of the Minnesota UU Social Justice Alliance. Before moving back to her home state in 2014, she served for 2 years as the Consulting Minister of the Universalist Unitarian Church of Joliet, Illinois. She lives in Minneapolis with her partner, the Reverend Karen Hutt, and their two children. Do note that our And Justice for All team, also known as the Anti-Racism team, will be hosting a discussion about today's message in the library after each service. All are welcome.
Let us worship together. Good morning.
Good morning.
Often the stories I tell in the morning are not true stories, so I wanted to make sure that, especially for the children here today, that they know that this is a true story. It's called The Children's Crusade by Kate Rode. "What are we going to do?" said Martin Luther King Jr., the well-known American civil rights leader, as he sat with his friends at a meeting in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Martin, who was trying to lead the black people of Birmingham in their struggle to end segregation, was worried that he and his friends were going to fail in their mission. Nevertheless, he rose in his chair in front of the group. "Who will demonstrate with me tomorrow in a brave attempt to end segregation? Who will risk going to jail for the cause?" Often, 400 people would show up for meetings like this one, but only 35 or so would volunteer to protest, and not all of these volunteers would show up for the next day for the protest march. Those who did would gather downtown and parade through the streets, carry signs, chant, sing, sending messages that segregation needed to end. In Martin's day, segregation meant that black people were not allowed to do the same things that white people could, go the same places. Black people couldn't go to most amusement parks, swimming pools, parks, hotels, or restaurants. They had to go to different schools that weren't as nice as the schools that the white kids went to. They had to use separate drinking fountains. And they could get in big trouble for drinking out of fountains marked for whites only. They weren't allowed to use the same bathrooms, and many times that meant that there were no bathrooms for them to use. They weren't allowed to try on clothes before they bought them, like white people could. Black people didn't think that was fair, and some white people agreed with them. And in the 1950s and 1960s, many thousands of people worked to end this segregation. But in many places, especially in the southern part of the United States, segregation was the law. And if black people tried to go somewhere they weren't supposed to go, they could get arrested, beaten, and even killed. In the spring of 1963, Martin Luther King went to Birmingham, Alabama, one of the largest and most heavily segregated cities in the South, to bring people together, to change this law. You see, people were scared. The sheriff in Birmingham, his name was Bull Connor, and black people didn't know what Bull Connor might do to them if he caught them protesting. Martin Luther King had already been in jail once, and others were afraid to follow him. Besides, they weren't sure that protesting was really doing any good. Martin, seeing that no one answered his call, again tried to inspire this group. "The struggle will be long," he said. "We must stand up for our rights as human beings. Who will demonstrate with me? And if necessary, who is ready to go to jail for it?" There was a pause. And then the whole group of people stood up. Someone gasped. All the people who stood up were children. The adults told them to sit down, but they didn't. Martin Luther King thanked the children and told them he appreciated their offer, but he could not ask them to go to jail. But they wouldn't sit down. They wanted to help. That night, Martin talked with some friends about the events of the day. "What are we going to do? The only volunteers were children. We can't have a protest with children." Everybody nodded, except Jim Bevel. "Wait a minute," said Jim. "If they want to do it, I say bring on the children." "But they're too young." Then Jim said, "Are they too young to go to segregated schools?" "No." "Are they too young to be kept out of amusement parks?" "No." "Are they too young to be refused a hamburger in a restaurant?" "No," said the others. "Well, then they're not too young to want their freedom." And that night, they decided that any child old enough to join a church was old enough to march. The children heard about this decision, and they told their friends, and their friends told their friends, and the time came for a march. 1,000 children, teenagers, college students gathered. The sheriff arrested them, and he put them in jail. And the next day, more kids showed up. Some of their parents came now, and relatives too, and they were arrested and put in jail. But even more showed up the next day and the next day, and soon lots of adults began to join them. Finally, 1,000 children were locked up together in a children's jail, and there was no more room for anyone else. Sheriff Connor had done awful things to try to get the children and the other protesters to turn back. He turned big police dogs on them. and he allowed them to bite the people. He turned fire hoses on them that were so strong, the force of that water could strip the bark off a tree. And he had ordered firefighters to point the hoses at the little kids and roll them right down the street. People all over the country saw the pictures of these dogs and of the fire hoses and what was happening to those children, and they were furious. So now the white people of Birmingham began to worry. People all over the world were saying really bad things about their town, and even worse, everyone was afraid to go downtown to shop because of fire hoses and dogs. So they decided they might have to change things. A short time later, the black people and the white people of Birmingham made an agreement to desegregate the city and let everyone go to the same places. Today, when people tell this story, they talk about Martin Luther King. But we should remember that there were thousands of brave children and teenagers with the courage to defend themselves and Bull Connor and fight Bull Connor and end segregation in Birmingham, Alabama, and the rest of the United States. The end. Please join us on singing The Children Downstairs. It's hymn 118, This Little Light of Mine.
Every year, we ask you, the members and friends of this church, to make a hopefully generous contribution to the church so that we can pay for all the things that we do. Worship, music, education, justice, caring, and more. This year, in addition to asking for your support for our ongoing programs, we're asking for something extra to pay for some needed repairs and upgrades. Things like the roof, new furnaces, sound equipment, and more. There are sign-up sheets for stewardship gatherings that will happen in the month of February out in the narthex. Please sign up for one today. You'll learn more about our projects and get to spend some time with some great people. As we lead up to this campaign, we want to hear from some folks in this church about one of the reasons they offer their financial support to our church and are supporting this campaign. Today, Shoko will share some words with you. Shoko?
Oops. Good morning. Well, last year, my friend Dwayne Welke asked me if I would share with you about what music, more specifically our choir of this church, Unicantors, meant to me. What? Why me? That was my reaction. Well, he intoned, you attend the church regularly and seems to like music, our singing a lot. That I do a lot. But singing and speaking in public are two things among many I don't do well and I don't like. But something compelled me to say yes. Beautiful, soaring melodies in harmony accompanied by Tim's piano, and especially when drums added, run through my busy and scattered minds and reaches way up and deep down. In this special suspended space where I believe my soul lives, I lose myself, sway my body, and tap my feet. That's the power of music. I am feeling the music. If only I could hear the word lyric better. hearing the music in full has been always my problem. You know the popular song Strawberry Field by John Lennon? Whenever it was played, I used to hum along casually and join him when he says, "But I'm not the only one who can sing." Then one day I read the whole lyric and realized that I had been missing essence of that song. See, I missed the first sentence. Imagine the world, there is no heaven. Profound, how could I miss it? Now, as a UU member and regular churchgoers for the first time in my life, I've discovered the importance of hymns, the importance of him singing hymns together. Most of the melodies are new to me, so I can't even hum along like this morning, but I do follow the words carefully, and they do resonate with me deeply. So I am so grateful that our Sunday service concludes with a wonderful closing song by Scott. I know the melody, I know the words, so I belt out. Though my voice is wimpy and low, but I swing my arms high, taking my fellow worshipers in joyous abandonment. And that's what music meant to me. Thank you.
Well, there's lots coming up at the church this week, and I want to highlight the church ski trip on February 6th. There's a packet of information in the narthex, so take a look. Also, all visitors are invited to join us for our introduction to Unitarian Universalism this Wednesday, January 20th at 5:15. Dinner will be provided. To RSVP, contact Belle Larson. Talk to her at the guest table after service or sign up in the narthex. We hope to see you there. We now take up an offering to support the work of justice and mercy in the world. 80% of what's collected today will go to the Minnesota Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Alliance, where our guest minister is the executive director. There's more information in your bulletin. Thank you for your generosity. The offering will now be given and received. Thank you. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "History will have to record that the greatest tragedy of this period of social transition was not the strident clamor of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people." I can certainly hear the strident clamor when I log on to my computer or turn on my television, or anytime I hear people denounce or criticize those fighting for racial justice. I certainly believe that Black lives matter equally to the life of any other. However, I must admit that I have been guilty of an appalling silence. Apart from silently agreeing with activists, I have done little to help. I should know that change can be made more possible when different communities lend their voices to the cause. I have seen that in my own life, as straight allies of every race and ethnicity have helped to advance equal rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. I, too, should do more to be an ally for racial justice. I'm proud to be a member of this church, where we have prominently displayed a Black Lives Matter banner and welcome discussions about race and provide opportunities to support movements of racial justice. And as I am searching for ways to break my silence and become a better ally, here today is a perfect place to start.
Mama. Choir, you are wonderful.
Thank you.
Our first reading is from a black revolutionary abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, 1857. Let me give you a word on the philosophy of reform. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress. In the light of these ideas, Negroes will be hunted at the North and held and flogged in the South, so long as they submit to those devilish outrages and make no resistance, either moral or physical. Men may not get all they pay for in this world, but they must certainly pay for all they get. If we ever get free from the oppressions and wrongs heaped upon us, we must pay for their removal. We must do this by labor, by suffering, by sacrifice, and if needs be, by our lives and the lives of others. And from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's 1963 letter from Birmingham Jail. I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the myth of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait until a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. This morning, my friends, we are going to engage in a little bit of weaving of word and prayer and song together. And I want to invite you to open your hymnals to number 168, one more step. And what we're going to do is this. We are going to sing together the first verse. I'll invite you to remain seated. And then between the verses, I'm going to offer some prayer and meditation. I invite you, as we move forward, to participate in whatever way most allows you to connect with what is holy and sacred to you in this community, whether that's singing or simply letting the music wash over you. Just follow me, you'll be okay. Sing with me the first verse.
One more step, we will take one. One more step.
Spirit of life, connective power within, among, and beyond us all, we give thanks for this hour to be together, worshiping and sharing our lives. There is so much among us, such grief and joy, loss and possibility, expectation and fear. And yet we are grateful for the covenant that binds us together, calling us toward a common destination of love and justice. May our companionship and love for one another give us the strength to keep moving always toward beloved community, step by step, act by act, word by word. Will you sing with me?
One more word, we will say one more word, till every word is heard by everyone. We'll say one more word.
This week, we hold in our prayers all who are suffering, both next door and around the world. We remember all people who have been displaced by war and terror, those who have lost beloveds to gun violence and police brutality, those who confront the daily dehumanization of racism, xenophobia, sexism, transphobia, or any other kind of oppression. As we struggle with our own numbness and cynicism, may we find strength and solidarity in making of our lives embodied prayers of clarity and vision, bringing into being a more just and peaceful world. Will you sing with me?
One more prayer, we will say.
And finally, on this Dr. King Sunday, let us honor the legacy of this man, not for what he accomplished alone, but in the context of the beloved community who empowered him, who struggled with him, and who fueled his vision. May the echoes of those radical voices for freedom fall upon our hearts today, as we receive the same call from the mouths of the young Black visionary leaders all around us who are urging, yet again, to join them in building a world in which people are truly free. May we find the courage, grounded in relationship, to join our voices with theirs, lifting up together a song of liberation and audacious hope. Let's sing one more time.
One more song, we will sing one more song, till every song is sung by everyone. We'll sing one more song.
May it be so. Blessed be, Ashe, and Amen. So it is December 23rd, and for the second year in a row, instead of getting our Christmas presents ready for my family or baking holiday goodies, my partner and I are putting on our clerical collars and getting ready to join with hundreds, maybe thousands, of our friends and neighbors in rallying at the Mall of America in solidarity with the local Black Lives Matter movement. A little bit of context about my family. Karen and I are both UU pastors, and she is Black and I am white. We have two children, 15-year-old Z, who is black, and 1-year-old Aspen, who is biracial. And if the family that protests together stays together, that's how the aphorism goes, right? Then we're in it for the long haul. Over the past year and a half, we have shut down freeways, rallied in courtrooms, disrupted a governor's speech, blockaded the state fair, occupied City Hall, and showed up with food and firewood almost every day at the 18-day occupation of the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis. So all this is to say that when we get word that the organizers are planning a reprise action at the Mall of America, the only discussion we even have is Karen asking me where her clerical collar tab is, and me wondering if she's seen the Sharpie so I can make a new onesie for Aspen because she's outgrown the last Black Lives Matter onesie that I made for her. So this day we are signed up to be a part of the crew of drivers who can transport folks to the mall for the protest, and so we show up at Cafe Southside, and we've got our two cars, two preachers, and one radicalized toddler ready to go. And I see lots of friends there, and many more faces that I have come to recognize by being in spaces like this together over the past year. And this is comforting to me because it turns out that I actually don't know what the plan is, which is intentional because we know that the police and the FBI and all sorts of other folks have been consistently infiltrating and spying on Black Lives Matter Minneapolis for the past year. And so when I missed the planning meeting, I knew that I wasn't going to get information on Facebook or on text or even face-to-face because of security measures. But I'm ready. We're showing up, and I trust that somebody will tell me what to do. So after a while, we line up in our cars, and we start taking passengers. And a friend of mine, who is one of the organizers, comes up to me and says, we actually need you in the last group that's going out to the second location. The second location? Yeah, you know, the second location. Do you know where that is? No, I say to my friend, and my friend says, okay, well, we think there's a police informant here right now, and so we're not talking about it out loud. Will you just follow us? I say, sure. Just don't lose me because I do not know where I am going. So we get on the freeway, and it is sleeting, and I'm tailgating the van in front of me so we don't lose them, and we blow right by the exit to the Mall of America. And I think to myself, huh. But I keep following, and something is beginning to dawn on me. And sure enough, a mile or two later, the van in front of me signals and drifts into the left lane, exit only, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. And I realize, suddenly, that the whole Mall of America thing has been a decoy, and the real target is the airport. And I'm, of course, mentally preparing to park and go in and chant in front of security or baggage claim one. And then the van in front of me stops in the middle of its lane with traffic backing up behind us. And one of the organizers jumps out and yells to me, pull your car diagonally across the next two lanes and start blocking the cars. And I finally get that we are not just going to protest. We are going to shut down all incoming traffic on the freaking international airport on the busiest travel day of the entire year. And I am being asked to literally use my car as a roadblock. Now, let me say here that my experience is that Black Lives Matter Minneapolis has been extremely thoughtful and conservative about how and when to use arrest as a tactic. When it is strategic, they always have a plan in place and they make sure that people consent to taking that risk. They've got a jail support team, they train people on how to maximize their chances for safety, and they've got a bail fund. If you are not looking to get arrested at a Black Lives Matter action, it is 99% certain that you will not. But on this particular afternoon, the signals have gotten a little crossed, and my friend, Part of the organizing team thinks that I am one of the crew who has volunteered to get arrested. And I know that if I don't pull my car across the center lanes right now, that this entire action may very well fall apart, and it will be my fault, personally. But still, as I'm being flagged toward the center lane, time slows down, and the questions pop up. So here's a glimpse into my inner monologue, okay? Oh God, Karen and the baby, what am I gonna do about breastfeeding if I end up in jail overnight? What about those people going home for Christmas? Won't this just make everyone mad? Why the airport? Why not City Hall or the police union or the state capitol? Is this strategy here today what I really want to commit to? Am I going to lose my job over this? I sent that email out last night to the state advocacy network for my people, and I already got 3 incredibly angry, we're never going to donate to you emails back again in the first 15 minutes after I sent it out. So am I too out ahead of the organization? And oh, holy hell, what am I going to tell my family at Christmas dinner tomorrow night? I was a mess, y'all, in the front seat of my little blue Prius with my clerical collar on. But man, oh man, was I being exactly who I had been socialized to be, as a white, cisgender, class-privileged, educated, liberal person. The fear for my own well-being, the take care of me and my tribe first impulse, the I don't want to make people mad at me thing. And then, of course, my favorite, the why aren't they doing the thing that I would be doing if I were in charge thing, right? Now, I want to talk about that last response for a second, because it is one that I encounter all the time from white people, including myself, obviously. I'm sure that you have heard some version of this, right? We support the cause, but we don't condone the tactics. You heard this? Have you said this? I have. What that declaration is usually followed by is, well, what you should really be doing instead is, and you can insert there a wide range of well-intended, but usually much less challenging or disruptive strategic suggestions there, usually offered in sort of a condescending, self-righteous tone. So I want to read you one classic example of this kind of response that I stumbled upon this last week. It says, "We recognize the natural impatience of people who feel that their hopes are slow in being realized. But we are convinced that these demonstrations are unwise and untimely. Just as we have pointed out that hatred and violence have no sanction in our religious and political traditions, we also point out that such actions as incite hatred and violence, however technically peaceful those actions may be, have not contributed to the resolution of our local problems. We do not believe that extreme measures are justified." That's not a response to the airport shutdown, or to the protests in Cleveland, or Chicago, or Staten Island, or Ferguson. That is actually writing from April of 1963, when the Southern Christian Leadership Conference held a series of anti-segregation marches that Kimberly talked about before. And the quote that I read is from an open letter entitled, "A Call to Unity," addressed to Dr. King and the SCLC, written by 8 prominent white liberal clergymen, all of whom had been actively involved in the civil rights movement up until that point. Now, of course, their letter is what prompted Dr. King to write his famous letter from Birmingham jail. And if you haven't read King's letter recently, it's 6 pages long, it's free on the internet, and it would be a favor to yourself to spend 20 minutes with it, because it speaks as powerfully and as pointedly to our current political situation as any contemporary commentary. I read this letter this week, and I knew how heartbreakingly little has changed in those 50 years. Once again, our nation is faced with a powerful mass uprising of black people, pointing out to us how unjust and inequitable and sinfully broken our laws and our institutions and our power structures are. Once again, freedom fighters are declaring that there can be no progress without struggle, because power concedes nothing without a demand. And once again, well-intended white people like me are being called to figure out whether we will collude with the power structures by critiquing and derailing and pleading for peace and order, or whether we will find a new way forward that will not only help free our black neighbors and friends, but also get ourselves free. Now I'm a pastor, and so that means I am in the business of salvation of souls and societies. And I'm a Unitarian Universalist pastor, which means that I am much more preoccupied with what salvation looks like here and now in this world than on any metaphysical plane. So as I look into my own heart, as I have conversations with other earnest, well-meaning white people, as I sit with the admonitions of Dr. King and Frederick Douglass and Ella Baker and Alicia Garza and so many other visionaries, I have to ask myself, what does salvation look like for me, for my fellow white people, for Unitarian Universalists? How can we be participants in our own redemption, as well as in the redemption of the world? Now, I certainly can't answer that question for everyone, but I do believe that what this growing movement for justice most crucially needs from white people, from privileged people, from people like me who always have that impulse towards sideline critique and evasion by way of suggestion, what is needed is for us to cultivate a spiritual discipline of followership. We need to become what our Christian ancestors would have called disciples. Now, I know that that terminology probably makes a few of you uncomfortable, but let me remind us all that the word disciple simply means student. It shares roots with the words discipline and discernment. To be a student, a disciple, is to open yourself up to learning new things, to strive to be wiser and more skilled, and fundamentally to acknowledge that you do not have all the answers. So you need teachers and mentors and comrades to fill in the gaps. Now, I'm sure it will be shocking for you to hear me say that faithful followership does not always come naturally to Unitarian Universalists. Anybody who's been to a board meeting will know this, right? One of the most basic reasons for this is that while there is considerable identity diversity among us, our prevailing culture is white, upper middle class, educated, and liberal. And it turns out white, educated, upper middle class liberal people are used to being in charge. We're used to thinking of ourselves as leaders and experts. We're used to walking into new spaces and having things to offer. We've got at least a vague opinion on anything you could throw our way. And we believe very deeply in questioning authority and doing what our own conscience says is right. It's right there in our principles, my friends. The problem with that constant expert posture, though, is that we forget how to be learners, how to be followers. It is not malicious, but when we find ourselves in situations where we are actually not qualified to be in charge, we either leave when we're not asked to lead, or we argue that we've got a better way of doing things. The result is that we not only get in the way of other people building power and connection and freedom for themselves, we fall short of those things for ourselves too. But I want to suggest, my friends, that although our cultural DNA as Unitarian Universalists makes it hard for us to be disciples, our theological DNA is what will ultimately save us and bring us back to followership. The most important practice of our faith is not the espousing of a shared creed or dogma. It is the life-giving, life-changing, life-saving practice of covenant. We believe that when we commit to walking together in accountable relationship for the long haul, we create something together that is greater than the sum of our individual parts. And because that something, which we frequently call beloved community, because that something is so holy and redeeming, we are willing to surrender to it, to let go of our need to always be in charge, to always be right, to always have every single one of our desires fulfilled for the good of the whole over the individual. So what if we look at this spiritual practice of covenant that we aspire to, that we practice in our congregations? What if we look at that and turn it outwards beyond our walls? What if we were to understand our participation in larger movements for justice as a covenantal relationship, one that calls us to humility and mutual support and faithful companionship? What if we were to lean in to the practice of surrender and discipleship, not to a charismatic leader or a particular ideology, but to the passionate, faithful belief that together we are so much more than we could ever be alone, and therefore it is our duty and our blessing to learn from the wisdom and leadership of people whose life experiences are drastically different than our own. Ultimately, this kind of deep belief in covenant is what I think redeems me. It emboldens and it sustains and it humbles me every single day. As I sat there in my little Prius on that December afternoon, wrestling with the demons of privilege and white supremacy and isolation and ego, I somehow, by grace, had a moment of clarity. I have committed to this movement, my heart said to me. To this community of people who are imperfect and messy and human, but who also share with me a vision of freedom and liberation for all of us. That commitment with these people to that ultimate ideal is what has been giving me life, saving me over and over again. And if I break our covenant, I will be out of relationship with them, with myself and everything that I hold most sacred. And so from somewhere deep inside me, from that well of groundedness that has been filled over a period of years by mentors and wise, loving friends who have loved me enough to patiently teach me how to get over myself and to just show the hell up when it matters, there comes a prayer to my lips and I say, God be with me now. And I wave my partner's car to come up next to me and I shout, you go ahead and park. I might get arrested. I'll call you later. I love you. And we lock eyes and she goes and she drives away and I crank that wheel hard and I pull across the center lanes and the traffic behind us stops and the honking and the yelling begins and I sit there, shaking with adrenaline, completely unsure whether this is the right tactic, but completely convinced that I have done the right thing regardless. And I yell out the window, hey, Jay, can I get that jail support number to write on my arm? This is not a story that ends with my dramatic arrest or a swell of heroic music. Our three cars sat there blocking traffic as the protesters walked very slowly in front of us, just long enough to draw a few dozen cops and five or six local news helicopters, who then broadcast this action to the entire nation that night. The protesters eventually moved off of the roadway and joined with the hundreds of other people who had come from the mall protest, had shut down the light rail line in the meantime, and who joined together in solidarity at the rally. And I drove away past the arrivals gate completely unscathed. I'm telling you this story not to aggrandize myself or to convince you that you too should be blocking traffic at an international airport. I don't recommend it, actually. But I tell you this story because it is my testimony about how one time our faith saved me and redeemed me, and for at least that one moment made me a disciple and a faithful follower. I want to practice a discipline of followership more and more. And I know that many of you do too. For you, it might not look like stopping traffic or showing up at a protest. It might be going to a city council meeting when you are asked to do so. Raising money from white people to fund local racial justice work led by folks of color. It might be showing up for the prayer vigil or the meeting when the black church across town calls you to be there, says they need you. No matter what it looks like, though, we need each other as companions and as co-learners. Because it matters that we show up and that we ask what needs to be done and we do it. It matters that we discern when we are called to lead and when we are called to follow. And it matters that we commit deeply, not just to ourselves and to one another, but to the ultimate cause of collective liberation, what our universalist ancestors would have called universal salvation of all of us here and now and forever. That kind of covenant, my friends, will redeem us. And it might just redeem the world. So come, let us follow together. May it be so. Blessed be Ashe and Amen. Friends, we are going to sing number 126, and I'm going to invite you to rise in body or spirit. For those of you who are people who really appreciate reading the accompaniment as you go along in your hymnal, you will be confused and sad because I'm bringing you this morning a wonderful, more upbeat arrangement of this hymn written by Angela Salvagioni, who is the pianist at the UU Church of Joliet. I invite you to rise or in body or spirit. We will have the leadership of the choir, and we will sing together and get through it.
Yeah.
So glad you were all here today for worship. I hope you take what you heard and bring into your own life and share with others. We'd love to see you all next week when Matthew will be preaching about Om and Om. What do electrical resistance and Hindu spiritual chanting have in common? We'll find out. If you know someone in your life who could use a message like that for their life, invite them and bring them with you. I will now extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry with us until we are together again. While I do that, I invite you to join hands together, and if you wish, for our benediction and blessing.
Dr. King wrote, "We are caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one affects all indirectly. In this knowledge, my friends, may we be courageous enough to show up, humble enough to follow, and blessed enough to witness and participate in the bending of the moral arc of the universe toward justice. Go in peace, my friends, to love and to serve the world. Amen." Let us sing together our sung blessing to close us out. The words are in your program. We'll sing it through twice.